Hey everyone, welcome to the Black Canvas podcast. So obviously this is a different setup for us. We are joined by a very special guest. We are joined by Natalie Campbell.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Wow, we've not actually been in a studio since 2019. So we're a bit rusty, but we're gonna roll with it. So basically, we felt that it was important for us to do it this way because there's a very, very important election coming up on the 2nd of May. And you know, here at Black Canvas, we are always plugged in with what's happening politically. So we just feel so honoured that you've made the time to be here. So this episode is going to be us talking about Natalie's manifesto for London, why you should vote for her. We want you to have all the information that you need to make an informed choice. And then we have a lot of options. It's not just about the main two. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's important that we actually engage what's happening politically. So this is us making things more accessible for you. So some of you have sent in some questions and some areas that you want us to talk about. So we're going to try and get to as many of that as possible. So if you see me looking down, looking at my notes. Okay, so what we usually do is we have a bit of an icebreaker.
Yeah.
We want to start on a high. What is your highlight of the week?
Well, my highlight of the week is probably my LBC interview.
I saw that interview. Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's the first time that people went, oh, no, she is who she says she is. As much as I know who I am, mm-hmm. I was surprised that other people hadn't seen it. And I think it's the first time that people were like, oh, okay, right, cool.
No, I think that was a highlight, definitely, because I saw it and I thought, oh my God, that's mainstream. Mm-hmm. That was great. So yeah, kudos to you. Highlight,
it has to be these interviews this week, guys. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I hate to be biased, but like Top said, we haven't been in the studio for a long, long while. And we love working in the studio, you know, it's a chance for us to see our expressions and mm-hmm. how we feel and, you know, put the words into like a little play. So yeah, I'm excited for this. I'm excited to talk to you, Natalie. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's my highlight.
Yep. I'd say my highlight is probably the same. Being in the studio, my other highlight is that I made it to my swimming lesson. So I started swimming lessons. You all know I started swimming lessons a couple of months ago, and with me being ill, I've not been the last couple of weeks, and I forced myself to go yesterday. Mm. And even though I still am not 100%, it was a great lesson. Mm. So yeah, highlight for me.
She's making strides, guys.
Are you swimming in a large pool or in a contained tank?
In a large pool.
Okay. So I did lessons in a contained tank.
Really?
Again, I'm sure it's, you know, trying to get your face in the water, getting through the fear. Small bits of progress make such a huge difference, right?
Honestly, before I was sick, just being in the deep end was a massive high. Same. Like the fact I didn't want to be anywhere near the deep end because I had this thing that I'm going to drown.
Yes.
And then she made me jump in. Mm. And then when I jumped in,
I'm not a jump in stage.
Trust me. Once you get
from the deep end straight in.
No, as in just literally jumping in the pool.
Yeah.
And in the deep end. And I was like, I'm going to drown. And she's like, no, you will come back up. Mm. And I came back up. Mm. And so, yeah, so it's all good. Okay. It's all good. Okay. So, we haven't got a lot of time, so before we get into, I guess, like the nitty-gritty of your manifesto, we want to just know a little bit about you.
Yep.
So we know your name is Natalie Campbell.
Yes.
We know you want to be London Mayor, mm-hmm. but we still want to know. We don't know anything else about you other than that. So really, really quickly, tell us about yourself.
The short tale. I'm a girl done good from Northwest London. I was raised by my Jamaican grandparents. They came over in the 60s. And I come from an entrepreneurial family. And so at the age of 15, I decided I wanted to be a CEO. In my family, that was really normal. I absolutely understand that that is not the experience that a lot of people back then would have had.
Mm.
But in saying that I wanted to be a CEO, I went on a journey of basically trying to make it happen. I thought that I was going to run a record label because I was inspired by 90s hip hop.
Right, I see.
I can't necessarily say the person that I was most inspired by because they're not in good grace right now.
Let's go there.
But it was that movement, the energy and the ownership mm-hmm. and this idea that you can make people feel good. And, you know, people are like, I'm the CEO of Rockefeller or Def Jam or whichever.
Yeah.
And I lived in Willesden and Jive Records was on my high street. So I thought that's the pathway. And very quickly I started interning and I realized it was never going to happen because the industry did not look like me. So I went to university and thought about what I could do. I thought I was going to open a coffee shop. And in the end, I opened a clothing store. There was a 90s high street brand called Morgan. Some people might remember it. It was a heart logo. I opened that as I was going into my final year of university. And that basically set my career off on a whole trajectory. I have a portfolio career, so a mix of boards, executive stuff. But everything I do always comes back to how can I make things better for people and how can I fix things?
Okay, interesting. So how did you go from that to politics?
So I still don't think of myself as being in politics. I think of my campaign as a startup and I think of what I'm trying to do as lifting a veil on something that is very opaque. And something that is very much a closed shop.
Right.
I guess it might not be until after the election that I go, oh, I did something political. I stay out of that mindset. But how did I get here? I have thought for a while that I wanted to do something significant in London. And the Mayor of London is one of those roles that is outside of the political fray because it actually has real levers for change. So a minimum budget of £17 billion a year. If I decide as mayor on Monday I want to do something, I can make it happen on Tuesday.
Sorry, you said the budget for London Mayor is 17 what?
Billion. At a minimum. So currently there's about 20 billion,
okay,
but the base budget is 17 billion. So when you hear a mayor say, I can't do X.
Right.
But you have the budget. No one else has the budget.
Interesting, guys.
Yeah. Don't mind that.
So the mayor actually controls post 16 skills and education.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know that. The new colleges that are being built around London, that comes from the mayor's budget.
Right.
From transport to policing to homes to arts and culture to the environment, all of that is under the power and accountability and responsibility of the mayor. I chose the Mayor of London over being an MP, for example, because MPs do not have levers. Their only lever is influence and advocacy. So if a mayor write, if an MP writes a letter to someone on your behalf, that person is bound to respond to the MP. With the mayor can just change something. And so I was like, right, that's what I want to do. Having worked with the current mayor for a while and seeing what he cared about and what he didn't care about, there was also a rising frustration in me that people were slightly being bamboozled, for want of a better word. Then Child Q happened, and the rage and the fire in me was deep. And then I was like, oh, ultimately, who is the person that can change this? And I tried to change it. I did a petition. I was working with DfE on the proposals behind the scenes in terms of the safeguarding guidance, because there was no guidance. And it didn't work because a minister stepped in at the last minute and said, well, what if a child has a razor up their bum? Therefore, we cannot ban the use of strip search in schools. So I was like, okay, well, who then has decision-making power? It comes back to the mayor. The mayor could decide tomorrow to ban the use of strip search in schools, at least as a start, and he's choosing not to. And actually, there is no candidate that is endorsing banning the use of strip search for children. We've got children under the age of 13, under the age of 10, being strip searched. I won't get on my high horse about that one. But anyway, I was like, I need to be the Mayor of London because I need to change things.
Yeah, fair enough. We are now. Fair enough. I mean, I think your motivations are understandable and perfectly reasonable. So in terms of like your journey to where you are, so you didn't start off as an independent candidate, or at least that's not initially what you wanted to do. So we asked online for people to send in questions, and we are definitely going to get into your manifesto. We're going to make sure we spend enough time on that. But there were concerns around that you were with a different political, you with a particular party.
Don't dance around it. No.
Oh, no, no, I'm not. Yeah, yeah. Have you met me? No. Initially, so yeah, initially you were Lib Dem, if I'm not mistaken, and then the Tory party.
Yes.
So where I'm standing, I'm like, those politics are very higgy hagger, right? So I'm like, why would you, why did you choose to go to the Tory party, given all we know about their politics, unless you agree with their politics? Do you know that? So that's the question.
So if I take a step back for a moment, everyone watching the campaign at the moment who is getting the opportunities to take part in hustings? Which parties?
The main, I guess the main two, or and the Green Party.
The main four. There's sort of a, someone has declared that only the main four can do anything. Mm-hmm. So as an independent, I am operating completely outside of a system. Remember, I'm not political. I don't have any political experience. Mm. It is absolutely easier to run for Mayor of London within a party because someone else puts up the money, someone else goes through the nomination process, and you get access to all of these things that I do not have access to. As I thought about running, I spoke to Labour, Lib Dem, and the Conservative Party. I started off with Labour, and the bottom line of it is, you're never going to be successful in this party. Full stop. Mm-hmm. I spoke to the Lib Dems. I was othered and then told that they have no desire to win the mayoral race. They're focusing on regaining seats in the southwest of
Good luck with that, Lib Dems.
England. And they had a very specific profile of who they wanted to run. And then I spoke to the Conservative Party and they were like, if you think you're good enough, run. That was it. I didn't even fit the criteria. So the base criteria is you should be a member for at least 3 months to be able to put yourself forward for a role. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a member. And so they were like, doesn't matter if you think you're good, go.
So it was purely an economic choice to join or to want to represent.
It's not an, this was February 23. Mm-hmm. It was a, how do I get in the game? How do I understand how to run? How do I even have a shot at winning? Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it is easier to win if you're in one of the two parties. And people say, well, you must align with their politics. Jeremy Corbyn and Keir Starmer are in exactly the same party, mm-hmm. at very different wings of the party. And so the thing that I had to do was say, well, if I'm going to go on this journey, I knew I wasn't going to get through the process. I'm not a Tory. Where would I align myself? Mm. And given that I was just a Lib Dem, the Lib Dem constitution, it's online. I've actually posted it. I've posted them side by side. When you put that next to the One Nation Tory manifesto, it talks about environmental stewardship, talks about life chances. It talks about citizenship. I was like, okay, One Nation, I can align with that. The rest, you lot are on something. Mm. That's not my politics, but that's where I can align myself to. Going through the process, that's how I got the data to understand how everything happens, why policies are made in the way that they are, how to even campaign. I don't even know that. How do you build an activist movement? Mm. What do you put on a flyer? Yeah, all of our references, I say from my perspective, in terms of politics, are American. If you go onto Netflix and you look up anything related to running, you've got Knock Down the House with AOC. So how do you learn this stuff if you're not in it? Mm. So I went in and I say now, given how much it's hurt people's feelings, probably naively thinking, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get some experience. People will see who I am, know that I am not a Tory because I didn't get through the process because I'm not a Tory. And it will all be fine.
Yeah. I mean, you're not a Tory. And I don't think it's necessarily that people's feelings are hurt. Mm. I think it's just confusing. I think that's more what it is. And we've spoken offline and we're speaking here. And I you're not a Tory, just from what we've spoken about. Yeah. But when people see that you joined and then also the MBE, mm-hmm. people are like, well, she must be a Tory. Mm-hmm. So it's that your politics is just confusing for people. I think that's what it is.
So could you not vote for someone that had an MBE?
Me? Mm. Probably not, no.
Okay. Did you ask Zoe if she'd ever accept an MBE?
No, I didn't, actually.
I think it's worth asking when you speak to other candidates, if offered an MBE, would they accept it?
But
or an OBE or a CBE? Go on.
For somebody coming from the African Caribbean community, mm-hmm. it's a specific issue because you're someone that should have shared experiences with mm-hmm. some of us. Do you know what I mean? Not generic, but shared in terms of your experiences in the UK. So that's why it's confusing.
So what's the problem, that I accepted it as a black woman or that I have it?
No, it's accepting it as a black woman, mm-hmm. of course, because it's like it's a, what we call a colonial
it's
trinket.
It's a colonial trinket.
But it's okay for someone else to accept that colonial trinket.
No. I mean, our expectation, let's be real, the expectation mm-hmm. for a white woman mm-hmm. that might have allyship or her focus on certain issues or whatever mm-hmm. compared to you would be different mm-hmm. from us. It just is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's, do you know what I mean? It's not about not being fair. It's about having a picture. Like for me, when mm-hmm. I saw, the first thing that came at me was, oh, she's a conservative. Mm-hmm. She's got MBE. And do you know what I mean? The mm-hmm. attitude around that was kind of like flippant to mm-hmm. where we strongly see it as, okay, is this about aligning yourself with elitism?
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, oh, I'm climbing the triangle
yeah.
because now I've got to the point where I have an MBE. It comes with, do you know, it comes with things, trinkets.
Mm-hmm.
So to us, it's kind of like, what's more important, the mm-hmm. integrity of who you're representing mm-hmm. and what you're trying to do, or, do you know what I mean, the yeah. title?
So I have a couple of things to say on this. We do not give black women any space or grace. And when I see black women being attacked
mm-hmm.
and I look at the front of the queue,
mm-hmm.
it's a lot of black women. So the expectation that you're putting on me to not accept it
mm-hmm.
is not the same expectation that you are putting on anyone else. We've just discussed it. Because you expect more from me. I get that. Let me, is that what you said?
Do you expect more from me?
No, it's not more. It's a different expectation. Like,
but it's still more. Because you're expecting me to not accept something that I've been offered, but it's okay
because
for someone else.
Do you see what I mean?
But it
has less implications for, obviously we would question, if Zoe had an MBE, we would have a discussion, but it would be a different discussion.
But would you still vote for her?
I said earlier that, I mean, I don't want to like dwell so solely just on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that I would be disappointed, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think given what their politics are,
mm-hmm.
I'd be disappointed if that was something that she would accept. Mm-hmm. The same way that I was disappointed that David Olusoga accepted his. Mm-hmm. I'm like,
yeah.
We all understand the history and we all understand what they represent. So it's more of a disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily expect more from you, but at the same time, it's just disappointing,
mm-hmm.
More so when I see black people accept it. It isn't to say, and I think we could just all be honest about why people accept it. I think where I get more annoyed is when people try to frame it as like some kind of Rosa Parks moment. Like it's-
No, I'm not. So I'm coming on to the second part around why I accepted it. I would never disappoint my granddad. I'd rather disappoint you than my granddad.
Right.
And when I, so I found out, just as we were going into lockdown and you're not allowed to tell anyone, and I told him, and I was like, you know, I'm not going to accept it because of this guy called George the Poet, who was like, he said all this stuff and didn't accept mm-hmm. his. And my granddad was like, so I'm going to say it in the nice way that he said it. He basically said, get your head out of your ass and stop being entitled. I did not leave my good Jamaica. I remember my granddad being from the Caribbean has a very different relationship to the Commonwealth
right.
than mm-hmm. we do.
Yeah,
my gran loved the royal family. As in, you know, I grew up with coffee table books. Christmas Day when the Queen's speech was on, you could not speak.
Yeah.
That's how I grew up. So for me saying to my granddad, I'm not accepting this thing.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, you go and get that MBE for the Campbell family. And I don't want to hear anything.
Mm-hmm.
So in that scenario, and I wasn't thinking about what I was going to do next. There is no professional elevation by having an MBE. There's no secret MBE club. There's nothing.
There isn't? You guys don't get like
nothing,
I don't know.
Literally,
like,
nothing happens.
It's
you pick up a medal and you've got some letters.
Okay.
I don't even use mine. So for me, it was like, okay, I'm going to go and get it. The only person that I would have taken was him and his mobility wasn't great. And so I didn't take him. I went alone, picked it up, came home. That was it. I didn't think of it beyond that point. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until it kicked off on Twitter.
Were you surprised by how people were?
Yeah. Because I'm not really on social media, so I don't see the debate.
Okay, then that's why.
In that way. And I definitely wasn't on Twitter at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
So when so from my perspective, I had just done one of the hardest things I've ever done. Like that nomination process was intense.
I can imagine, yeah.
And I just put 20 grand of my own money or the bank's money on the table. And then
I went online. The 20 grand, sorry.
I was paid £10,000 to get onto the ballot and £10,000 to be in the booklet.
Why is it so much?
Because they don't want people to run.
Well, yeah.
And everyone else used funders' money, donors' money, people that we don't know, people in parties use their members' money. Right. That's my money. I am paying that money back for the next 5 years at a rate of 7.9% APR.
Oh, God.
So I did all of that. And then I didn't know what was going on. I was at home. My phone was blowing up. My friend was messaging me. And she was in the chat of this site that I actually believe is anti-black. But people seem to think it's part of the community. And actually, they're misogynist as well.
What site is that?
Yeah. Shadeboro.
Oh, yeah.
But I'd never heard of it.
We're with you there.
I never heard of it. But it was all kicking off. And then I jumped on Twitter and I was like, I've just done a really good thing. Mm. And everyone is coming at me. It was the first day of my period. And I was like, pap, pap, pap.
I need to get a social media manager.
Do you know what it is?
I was like, no, who are they speaking to?
What's changed, I think, is that like a lot of our generations are very invested with current affairs. Mm. I wouldn't like not necessarily all politics, but current affairs. So they are going to be a lot of debates and opinions on what's current and what impacts them. Mm. So I know it would seem like an attack, but people are generally speaking because they're honestly saying how they feel about it, especially, you know, again, with an expectation that they would have with someone that's
And the thing is, you're not wrong. Like, we're black women, so we absolutely understand that struggle. Like, we do get scrutinized more. So absolutely, we're with you on that. And so I understand that. And you're right, that is going to happen. And I think especially when you put yourself forward, not just in our circles, but mainstream politics. I mean, we've seen what it's like for black women in politics. So we absolutely understand what that is like for you. And we definitely want to give you the chance to speak to that as well, because I think it's really important that people also understand what that struggle is like, because there will be struggles that you will share with other women within politics, but for black women it's different. It's absolutely different. So I want to get into your actual manifesto. Like, that's really what we're here for. We want to understand, all right, what are your plans for London? So what we've done is we've kind of put it into categories that are really important to people. So we've got like the environment, the community, housing. I mean, housing was a huge thing. Like, everyone, a lot of the questions we get is around like, what's she gonna do for housing? What's she gonna do for housing? Mm-hmm. Policing is another huge one, and the economy. Mm-hmm. So, right, where do we start? All right, let's start with housing.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the things that I saw in your manifesto was around homelessness. Mm-hmm. Now, we saw with COVID that if we want to get people off the streets, we can get them off the streets. Absolutely. And I've always said that I think one of the biggest failings of any government anywhere in the world is homelessness.
Absolutely.
So you plan on tackling homelessness. That's something that you've said in your manifesto. So I want to get into that. So how do you plan on doing that?
So before I even came up with this idea that I could end youth homelessness specifically, I visited charities and organisations that are supporting young people in different ways, either through employment, through wraparound services, through acute support and care. And I realised that ultimately young people are homeless because it is a political choice. The system has been saying for a long time what needs to happen, but politicians aren't listening. And I absolutely believe that with the right level of funding, we can tackle it in 4 years. So my first approach was to say, well, where do I get the money from? I've decided that it will be a tourist levy, and I'm saying it's a good night's sleep for a good night's sleep. There are 200,000 hotel rooms in London. Every time we go to another city, you go to Paris, you go to Barcelona, you go to Milan, you go to New York, there's a whole load of city taxes on your bill. Those taxes go towards doing things within the city. We don't have that. All I'm saying is we'll apply a small tax, probably to rooms over a certain amount, to generate enough revenue to pay for a pilot of ending youth homelessness. If you can end youth homelessness, first of all, you end the early stage tail, which means you then, over the long term, don't have the acute need yet. Right, 45% of people that are still homeless or rough sleeping at 40 and 45 started out and were rough sleeping when they're 25.
Yeah.
So there's that. It's also to prove that it can be done, because there are lots of people that keep saying it can't be done. There are lots of politicians that say it can't be done. So we've got the funding. Centrepoint, Shelter, Crisis, New Horizons Youth Centre have all been talking about a housing first, home first approach, where you provide good quality temporary accommodation with wraparound support and care. One of the reasons that people end up back on the streets is because that is where the community is. Whether you're comfortable or not, that is where you feel safe and you're not lonely and you have community. So it's not just about finding someone at home. There has to be the support and the community and the care. People need to be loved on. That is what we need to focus on.
I need some love.
So many people in London need love.
We all need it, honestly.
So it's working with those organisations and others. So I've met people that run restaurants that only work with people that are leaving situations where they've been homeless. Organisations like Hestia that do the mental health wraparound support. Like, I'm not just out here throwing this stuff out.
You've actually engaged with charities, visited,
mm-hmm. listened, sat down. So you bring together this consortium to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And then the way that you do it in business is, you know, you rapidly test stuff. Mm. So we have to find the sort of temporary accommodation that's going to work. I would speak to hoteliers. Hotels are going up in London like that. Mm-hmm. So we don't need to wait 3 years for a new housing development. We could partner with a Whitbread group and get these rooms turned over, as in the space is built very quickly. So it's thinking about, how do you marry public-private partnership to get an outcome? So that's how I'd approach that one.
Yeah.
To then add on to your next bit, so lots of people keep saying, because my position is good homes and happy neighbourhoods. They're like, what about affordability? Mm-hmm. That's what I mean when I say good homes and happy neighbourhoods. No one is happy in an unaffordable neighbourhood. Mm-hmm. So anyone that is telling you that they are going to apply rent caps is selling you pipe dreams.
Well, you that was only... going to be another, the next question.
It's not possible.
Would you introduce rent caps for landlords?
It already exists.
Right, okay.
So you cannot, as mayor, say you're going to introduce rent caps for private landlords without it being national policy. There is no national government that will make it a policy, because people that own homes vote. That is how it works. So if people are saying it, they're lying. What you can do, and it's what I'm currently living in, is invest through public-private partnerships in build-to-rents.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In Wembley, the build-to-rents, some of them are rent-capped, and they're means-tested against salary, so you're not paying any more than 40% of your salary on your rent. Mm-hmm. I live in one right now. This isn't new. It's just people, you know, want to have something new to say.
What about access? Because, again, with affordability, even in people that can acquire private accommodation, because at the moment that's the better route to go, because the councils...
Build-to-rents are private. Build-to-rents are private.
Yeah, so I'm saying, like, for me as a private renter, what is the protection if, you know, say I'm out of work, you know, I've got children, and then the local housing allowance won't cover my rent because of the market increases. Do you see what I'm saying? So that sounds good, that idea, but then it's about people in positions that can't access that and maybe need support directly from the local authority, because the local authority, it's like I was saying on Zoe's interview, separate. So the local authorities are acting separately and private sector's acting separately. Yeah. So private sector said this area, the average is 1900 a month. Yeah. The council saying we only pay out 1100 a month. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? They're at risk of being homeless again. Because, do you see what I'm saying?
So what I'm talking about is actually where there is a public-private partnership already.
Okay.
So in Wembley, the caps are set by the local authority. Mm-hmm. And so the cap is not going to be any more than they will be spending, or what the budget would be on housing benefit.
Got you.
And that's why it has to be a public-private partnership. Mm-hmm. So you'd have those ones. So how it works in Wembley is you've got those ones that are already set. You've got what I live in, which is more on the private side of build to rent.
Right.
Where there's complete transparency around what everyone is paying, and your utilities are sort of an itemized amount based on meters, and you get lots of communal space. The reason that I want to focus on that is because the way it adjusts the rest of the market, and this is the economics coming into play, is if you have high quality build to rents that are really transparent, landlord over here that is selling damp, moldy, you know, horrible flat at X amount, either has to fix up or reduce their price. So you influence the market that way. Mm-hmm. Anyone telling you that they're gonna influence it through regulation, it's never gonna happen, because national government will never do it.
Really quickly, I know we need to move on. How would you go about making these, marrying the two initially? Like, is that a long process, or do you know what the process is?
You set up development corporations. So I've been on the board of the Mayor's Development Corporation for 4 years. So you would set up develop. So the two already exist. So we'd set up another development, or three actually exist. We'd set up another two development corporations in the first 4 years at least. And it's where you earmark parcels of land that are already portioned in the London plan. And you basically say, this is going to be now build to rent. It might have been earmarked for purely private, mm-hmm. but it's actually, we're going to co-invest and we're going to make these build to rent properties based on this framework. And you'd make it capped and means tested against salaries, which would then align with benefits. Basically, we're not going to solve the housing crisis by taking a social only approach. It has to be public private.
Okay, and then you've said in your manifesto that you want to build 40,000.
I'm matching what Sadiq said, but I also said to build 40,000 homes, you cannot achieve net zero. The two are not compatible. The biggest emitter of emissions is the construction industry.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. I mean, how would, if with that pledge, are there also plans to address people? Like, you know, with gentrification, a lot of the time you push local people out.
Yeah.
With that pledge for 40,000 homes, have you considered the actual existing people that live in these areas not being priced out?
So that's the one thing that I've been talking about. So when I talk about happy neighbourhoods, it's not just about more. Me matching his pledge was me being facetious to try and get journalists to actually ask him a question around how he's going to achieve net zero.
Right.
I visited the Cash community in Southall. They're a community that had been displaced based on the new big development in Ealing. And my focus on happy neighbourhoods is making sure that when developments happen, and it's not just developments, it's also retrofitting, mm-hmm. we're not pushing out the communities that have built the neighbourhood for generations. Mm-hmm. And there are ways to do that. So Wembley is actually a really good example. You walk around Wembley and where I live, and it still looks like the community that has always been in Wembley.
Right.
So gentrification is not the only solution if you start building new homes or retrofitting. That comes back to affordability and, mm-hmm. and other things. So the focus on happy neighbourhoods means that there needs to be protections for the communities that are there. There needs to be protections around compulsory purchase orders. The way that the land is apportioned, you can't just throw up loads of high rises, which is what's going on in Ealing. You have to have a mixed use of family homes, community spaces. No public spaces built in that land should be inaccessible mm-hmm. to the local community, which is happening in Ealing.
Yeah.
So you put those protections in place, but and they go into this document called the London Plan. That's how I'll tackle it.
Okay. Cool. I like the sound of all of this. Okay, so I want to quickly move on because I want to make sure that we address policing.
Yes.
Big one.
So it's no secret to anyone. We all know that the relationship with the Met Police and the Black communities is very fractured. I would even say that the relationship is non-existent at this point. Yeah. One of the things that you mentioned in your manifesto that you want to establish 320 new neighbourhood centres. Yes. Each one will house 1,300 police officers. Now,
not each one, it's so in total.
Oh, in total, sorry. In total, 1,300 police officers. Mm-hmm. If you're putting these centres in neighbourhoods, in neighbourhoods where people don't actually trust the police, so which one do you want to do first? Are we going to actually address the relationships first? Because I think it's all great putting these centres in the communities, but if the community does not trust the police, mm-hmm. and also we need to get onto how you would even attempt at reforming the police. Mm-hmm. So that is a really long question, I want to try and have a holistic approach to, we need to address the fact that the police, and we know from the Casey report and every other report, mm-hmm. that the Met Police are institutionally racist, and I know you do agree because I saw your LBC interview. How do you even go about reforming the police? And then once you do that, these communities, like, what will be their function?
Yeah. So let's roll back. Mm-hmm. The trust compact between the Met Police and society, full stop, is broken. So it's not just the Black community. If, as a woman, if a police car pulled up next to you, it's 9 o'clock and they said, there's danger ahead, get in.
Oh, I'll take my chances, mate.
But
I would not, no.
You say that to any woman and they're not getting in. And it's exacerbated across all communities. So the trust compact is fundamentally broken. Mm-hmm. In an organisation that has to operate regardless, you cannot stop it, fix everything and start again. Like, you can't fly it, you know, if the plane's broken, you're going to have to continue flying it and fixing it at the same time. So my approach when thinking about the Met is, we have to rebuild trust at the same time as we increase visibility. So more
police officers.
No, so this is where the neighbourhood centres come in. Okay. At the moment, what we've got is a massive level of distrust, and we don't see them until after the fact of something's happened or at a moment of heightened tension. Mm. I grew up with a police station on my high street. PC Fox used to come to my school. So when you saw someone in uniform, that element of aggression, attack, and they're out to get me wasn't there. That heightened sense of anxiety that young people tell me they feel when they see that authority figure, it wasn't there when I was growing up. So the neighborhood centers for me are about creating hyper-local policing, where we have not just police officers and a front desk, but other wraparound support services like mental health support all in one place. So you start to create these community hubs that people can access and go into. So on a high street, if something kicks off, you're not waiting for flashing blue lights to come in. They're right there. Automatically, that starts to shift and create a different dynamic of how people see, experience, and feel the police. You know their name. Mm-hmm. They should be going into schools not to say, I am the police, but to do story time. So read Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill or whatever the kids read in school.
So you don't think, sorry to cut you, I'm just conscious of time. Mm-hmm. So you would support police officers being in schools?
I support creating a relationship between police officers and the Met Police and every single person that lives in London.
Are you talking about allocating specific officers to specific areas so they build relationships with that neighbourhood? So it's like, oh, PC Angel and PC Tom are allocated to this school,
yeah,
right? But you still need to be careful with how you introduce that.
Absolutely. All of this stuff has to be done carefully because the trust compact is so broken. But we can't not do it. It is literally the only way to rebuild trust. We can't remove them and have them not there. Like, not having a police force is not an option.
Unless we're going to say we're just abolishing the idea completely.
I
think the issue is the trauma that exists. I think that's the... Do you know what I mean? I think that's what worried me.
The anxiety. When I heard it, was like... Absolutely.
Yeah, because I personally don't want... As a parent, I don't want police in schools. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that is the function of the police. Mm-hmm. Because we've spoken about it on the channel, and we spoke about this with Zoe when she was on, about how we've had conversations about defunding the police, abolishing the police. That's a movement that is very big in the US. Yeah. It's picking up steam here a little bit. Personally, I don't know what we would do if we abolished them, so I'm not quite there. But I do believe that they should be defunded. I do think that they've got too many fingers and too many pies.
Yeah.
And I think what I would want to see is actually them pulling back from some of these places, and schools is one of them. I don't believe that schools need to necessarily have a relationship with the police. I think that there are other things that we could be doing in schools.
If I give you a different, if you were in a relationship with someone,
yeah,
and they cheated, and you were willing to give them a second chance, what is the best way to rebuild that trust? To see each other once a month, or to try and see each other a little bit every day?
So I would never take back a cheater. Just my husband's watching. Just don't do that.
Okay.
No, I hear what you're saying.
But focusing on that rebuild trust. If you have to rebuild trust, okay, with a friend that you've fallen.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing
it's
like
more about the function.
She's I'm talking about the function of the police. I agree. I do, despite the way that I feel about the police, they are a necessary service. Yeah. However, I think there needs to be a conversation about, okay, what powers should they actually have and what should they be involved in? Do they need to be in schools? Absolutely not, right? We spoke about Child Q and all this kind of thing. They don't need to be in schools. I think children, we need to be maybe putting more funding into social care, social workers, mental health, policing. They are about... it's criminalized. If anything, I feel like it criminalizes children already. We don't need a police officer in a school.
So I disagree based on just my own personal experience of how I... So basically, I'm saying I hear you, and I'd be very willing to have the conversation around how we rebuild trust. From my experience, having people in uniform, because it wasn't just police, it was the fire service, it was paramedics, it was people in uniforms that could appear intimidating to everyone coming in, not in their uniformed authority self, to do story time. That's what happened when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so the core of the idea of what I'm saying is, how do we create a dynamic and a relationship which is where they're not a threat, but they are on this high street and they are part of the community and they know parents and guardians and carers and they know your name. Because the reality is that we know the young people that will end up carrying knives. They are the 85,000 children that are currently homeless in London. Mm-hmm. They have the highest propensity to carry a knife or be the victim of knife crime. Mm. So if we know that now, why are we not supporting them now? And part of that support is the dynamic that they have mm-hmm. with the policing authority figures around them.
There's so much to break down.
And I think we all want the same thing. It's yeah. about how we get there. Yeah, and sure. I think, first and foremost, obviously it's about reforming the police in its current state.
So it's not even the word, it's a reset, it's a reconnection. Reforming is not going to work.
Okay.
So it's rotten. Reform doesn't work. Mm-hmm. The closest thing is literally dismantling it and rebuilding it. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, there are conversations around
that. You can't stop
it
completely. You have to rebuild it whilst you're also policing.
But you can stop them.
From a different angle.
But you can stop them being in schools. I feel so passionate about that, just because as I'm a parent.
I'll accept that if
my child was disruptive or something like that, why on earth are you calling a police officer?
No, so I don't believe that should happen at all.
Right.
So for me, the two things are separate.
Okay.
I'm not talking about police going into school, and that's the work that I was doing with DfE was on exactly that. Mm. They shouldn't be in school for that. Right. That is the school's business. Mm-hmm. They should be going in to do reading time.
Ew. Sorry.
I don't want you reading to my kids. Sorry, go away.
And like, it's like Officer Tom's come to talk to you about.
Actually, do you know what? I just clocked a memory. So when I was in primary school, mm-hmm. there was this competition that the Met Police used to do. Mm-hmm. So I went to school in Stoke Newington. So anyone who's listening, if you know, they did a competition mm-hmm. where you had to answer questions, do a presentation mm-hmm. on policing. And at the end, somebody won. And I actually won. Yeah. And you got a medal and everything mm-hmm. like that.
How did it make you feel?
It made me feel like I accomplished something. And part of your project, you had to go to a police station, mm-hmm. you had to interview a police officer.
And how was that?
And it was great. At that time, it was great. I was mm-hmm. young.
If we could recreate that.
I mean,
it doesn't tackle the whole issues.
But it's a tiny bit. We're talking about a tiny bit of a massive systemic challenge,
we
right?
We are. And I think we're talking about several things. I think the issue around, okay, if there's problems in school, mm-hmm. police
that's
shouldn't be called.
Separate.
And that's, yeah, yeah. I think... that is, and we agree on that. Mm. If there's a problem, we shouldn't
it's
be calling
the last
police.
People we should be calling
parents, social yeah. workers.
Agreed.
And there are organisations, and there are grassroots organisations that, you know, need more funding.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm. Going into police and, you know, PC Bob and, you know, fine. Mm-hmm. But I think, yeah, we're agreed that when
we're aligned there.
They shouldn't be cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to quickly go on, right? Because there's another question that, and this is what we're going to round on. Mm. So the economy, we know that it's very, very expensive to be in London. Mm. And you've spoken about how you would look at housing, all that kind of stuff. But one of the things that we've had is around support for working parents. Mm. Childcare is disgustingly expensive. Mm. Do you have any plans around supporting working parents in London with childcare and just making it more affordable, more accessible?
So the reality is it's not within the scope of what the mayor can do. Unless it's within its national policy. So there's an actual GLA Act which determines what the mayor can and cannot do and what the mayor can and cannot fund.
Right.
So I can fund a workspace to provide facilities to set up a nursery.
Right.
I cannot fund the people to run the nursery.
Okay.
I cannot fund the activities that happen within it.
Because it's a private service, is that why?
It's more complicated in terms of statutory duty.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So the mayor actually can't do anything on social care. The mayor can do public health, but not social care. The mayor generally can't really do things in schools. The mayor sort of can do things in academies. It's a blurry line. Mm-hmm. So previously, I used to say to the current mayor that we should be doing more in primary schools around entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. It's like, we're not allowed to fund stuff there. The free school meals campaign is funded as a public health approach. Right. But typically that wouldn't be the sort of thing the mayor could fund. Mm-hmm. So there are very clear lines around that.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, there is nothing I can do to help you with the cost of childcare, but I can absolutely influence and be a champion back to government to say we need to get this mm-hmm. sorted. The reason it's not a priority for government is because women do not vote. I cannot say this loudly enough. People that show up in voting data, mm-hmm. get policies made for them. Mm-hmm. Women do not vote. Men over 55 vote. And then the assumption is women vote based on, because every woman is married, based on how their husband votes.
Right.
Oh. I found that out by being inside the system.
Right. I think
trying to change these.
We are trying to change that, and I think we have to round up now. We could literally be here all day because I'm so fascinated by just getting a bit more insight into how it all works. And one of the things that I do definitely want to credit you on is that I do think you've been really transparent about just because it's very there's a mystique around politics. Yeah. So I think one thing that I think you've done extremely well on your platform is being very transparent with you know how much things cost. I mean, I had no idea about this kind of stuff. Mm. You know, what you can and what you can't do. So I think that what you've done, I think, is no matter what happens on the 2nd of May, I think that you've definitely made things a lot more transparent, and hopefully that encourages people to engage more. Mm. So we do need to wrap up. So before we go, what is the last thing? Because we've spoken about a lot of different things and we've not been able to go into detail into everything. But if you were to just want to leave people with one last thing, what would you say?
So my one thing for everyone is to vote. You don't have to vote for me.
Don't say that.
No.
If you want votes, say you want votes.
No. But what people need to realise, my purpose and my mission isn't about me. It's that I saw the data. Black women do not show up in polling data. So when we say these things are happening to us, there are healthcare inequalities, that we're not being treated right, it's because we're not catered for. So we just need to show up. If it's not for me, I don't care who you vote for. I just want you to show up in the polling data, because then we will start to see change. And everyone else that's not a black woman, vote too, because you count somewhere within this mix. Mm-hmm. But if you are not visible when they look at the data, there is absolutely zero chance that they will create policy for you.
Yep. I think with a lot of people, they've just become disillusioned with stuff. And I mean, with everything that's happened in the last couple of months, I know that's something that we can't really go into, but Palestine is a huge issue. What are your thoughts on that? Ceasefire?
Absolutely a ceasefire.
Yep.
It's clearly an apartheid situation. My problem is I do not like to people telling me what I should and shouldn't do. And the thing people should be asking me is not, have I posted, have I donated, have I actually done something to contribute to the cause? Mm. My post is not helping a child that is suffering in Gaza right now, but my donation can help. Mm-hmm. So that got me angry. Yeah. The next thing that I would say is we have wars raging all over the world led by megalomaniac, tyrannical men. Using Agreed. Women and girls as gun fodder. And you can go literally continent to continent. It is happening. Mm-hmm. And world leaders are idly sitting by, typically male world leaders are idly sitting by, pointing fingers at each other. Mm-hmm. And so at the same time that I mentioned Palestine, I mentioned DRC and I mentioned Sudan.
Good.
And I mentioned the girls that still have not been that still have not got back home in Nigeria.
Yeah.
Yep, from yep, however
many
long.
Of them still but missing. Yep.
No one was trying to tell those stories for a long time. Mm. So all I'm trying to do is say I absolutely support a ceasefire in Palestine, but I'm just going to use this space to also say there are lots of other people suffering around the world too.
Thank you for that. Because we see that every week London is coming out. So if you want to be the mayor, it's good to hear that you do support that. So I'm rushing, but this
appreciate
has been great.
Yeah.
Appreciate you so much for coming here, because I know how busy you are. We're going to end on that. Look, the election's on the 2nd of May. Please, 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 please go and vote.
Yeah.
You heard what Natalie said, even if you don't vote for Natalie, but it's really important that we have our voices heard. You have to be in it. Mm. To win it. So thank you so much for joining us. If you're not following us, please follow us on all of our socials, Black Canvas TV. We'll leave all our details in the description below. We'll also leave Natalie's website where you can get a bit more information about her manifesto, all that good stuff.
That's it.
Bye everyone.
Thank you so much.
Bye.